This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there, it's the Religion and Ethics Report. Andrew West here on RN and the ABC Listen app. Just how far should freedom of conscience extend to medical professionals? That story is soon. America's Catholic bishops have elected a prominent conservative as their next leader. Archbishop Timothy Broglio, chief chaplain to the Defence Forces, is a potentially controversial choice. He could find himself swept up in the next US election and also out of step with Pope Francis. Joshua McElwee is news editor of the independent newspaper, The National Catholic Reporter.
He's a bit of a controversial figure because in the 1990s, he had served in the Vatican as the secretary for Cardinal Angelo Sodano, who at that time was the Vatican Secretary of State, a very high-ranking role under Pope John Paul II. Sodano is the same official who in the late 90s really protected and defended Marcel Maciel, the serial sex abuser who founded the Legionaries of Christ, a religious order. He would eventually be defrocked and would die kind of in shame in the early 2000s. It doesn't appear that many of the bishops in the room kind of understood Broglio's connection to Cardinal Sodano. Broglio himself kind of swiped it away in a press conference after the vote, kind of saying that hindsight is 20/20, claiming that he had not been in the office when Cardinal Sodano was making decisions about Father Maciel or other abuse cases.
And we need to point this out. There's not a suggestion that Archbishop Broglio covered up accusations of child sexual abuse that came before that office, but it's the association, his closeness to that controversial Cardinal Sodano, who allegedly did cover up.
Yeah, Cardinal Sodano was in a very powerful position in John Paul II's Curia, kind of the second pope or the vice pope role. In the Secretariat of State, they were certainly receiving reports about Father Maciel from the early 90s forward. A journalist named Jason Berry here in the U.S. has really covered that extensively and have brought to light some of the reporting from the time. It's quite clear that Archbishop Broglio was working for Cardinal Sodano in this time as a secretary. It's not clear what Archbishop Broglio would have seen as a secretary or, you know, what kind of paperwork was going over his desk, but it's certainly quite interesting, and the Vatican is very good at keeping documents, so I wonder what documents are available in the Vatican archives and what might be made of those.
How would we classify Archbishop Broglio in terms of church politics in the United States?
People don't like it when you try to classify bishops as conservatives or liberals here in the U.S., but I think it's fair to say that Archbishop Broglio is a center-right or more to the right in terms of his church ecclesiology. It's quite interesting. As the chief chaplain in the U.S., he wrote a letter expressing agreement with religious exemptions from COVID-19 vaccinations for chaplains who choose not to be vaccinated.
And this was at the time when Pope Francis was encouraging people to be vaccinated.
Yes, exactly. The Pope was basically saying it's your duty to your fellow Christians or to your fellow people to get vaccinated to stop the spread of the coronavirus. The Pope in late 2020 gave an interview in which he basically called it a moral obligation to get vaccinated, accepting if there were some medical reason why it would be dangerous for you to do so. A few months later, Archbishop Broglio wrote this letter allowing or seeming to allow Catholic chaplains in the U.S. military to choose not to be vaccinated for conscience reasons.
How do you think the Vatican will view the election of Archbishop Broglio to such a sensitive post?
I've spoken with some Vatican officials who are a little shocked, I think I would say, by the decision. They're kind of wondering what led the U.S. bishops to choose Archbishop Broglio, especially when there were a number of other candidates who were more known, particularly Baltimore's Archbishop William Lurie, who also ran for the post and looked like he would have been a more centrist candidate. I think there is some wonder at the U.S. Bishops' Conference in Rome, particularly with regard to the fact that this is a three-year term. So this is the person who will be in post for our next presidential election in 2024. And there is some wondering in terms of how Archbishop Broglio will position the U.S. bishops during that presidential election, if he will take kind of a moderate tone and not try to embrace kind of the right-wing elements in the Catholic Church. The U.S. bishops had been criticized for the way they had responded to the election of Joe Biden, who's a Democrat, who's a Catholic in favor of maintaining abortion rights. Archbishop Broglio's predecessor, Los Angeles Archbishop Jose Gomez, had written kind of a letter at the election of Joe Biden that really framed it as a problem for the U.S. bishops that the president was a Democrat and Catholic. Initially, Archbishop Gomez had launched an initiative to try and see if the bishops might try to suggest that Joe Biden refrain from going to communion. That was eventually toned down, but now I think there's a lot of question about how this new president, Archbishop Broglio, will respond when it looks like, very likely, that the presidential race in 2024 will include President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump.
Do we know what kind of message the U.S. Catholic bishops were trying to send both to the United States but also to the Vatican by electing Archbishop Broglio as their leader?
My sense from speaking with bishops in Baltimore who were at the meeting is that there were some bishops who really wanted to send a more conservative message to the Pope and thought Archbishop Broglio was their guy. I think there were also bishops who weren't as familiar with Archbishop Broglio's background, particularly his work in Rome for Cardinal Sodano at the Secretary of State, and had kind of gotten to know Broglio as the number three official for the past 3 years with the conference, and he had served as the secretary of the conference. And so I think it's a bit of a confluence of, you know, some bishops who were really pushing Broglio as a conservative candidate and others who didn't quite see him that way and just saw him in a previous role in the conference. It's a strange combination of headwinds.
What does seem to upset some of the Catholic hierarchy in the United States about Pope Francis? Because if you think of the issues that might be preeminent for them, Pope Francis is still pro-life. He's still in favor of traditional marriage. He says children should have a biological mother and a father. I mean, what is there for them to be upset about?
I think at heart, there are a number of U.S. bishops who don't really understand Pope Francis's call for a culture of encounter, and they would prefer to keep a culture of culture war or of kind of keeping our lines very firm. They continue to see the Democratic Party and its stance of protecting abortion rights, even if it's not total abortion rights, but up to a certain point in pregnancy. They continue to see that, as they put it a few years ago, a preeminent issue for American Catholics, and they prefer to keep kind of their sides entrenched and everyone kind of in their bunkers, fighting that culture war ad infinitum. What Pope Francis is clearly calling for is a culture of encounter. What he says is better to build bridges than to build walls. And I think would prefer a culture where we work with people, we meet with them, we express our disagreements where they are, but then we find areas where we can work together.
Josh McElwee of the National Catholic Reporter. Right-wing parties won a clear victory in Israel's recent election. Forming a government, however, is proving harder than the likely Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu expected. The religious Zionist bloc wants key security jobs in the cabinet. A recent riot by Jewish settlers in Hebron has also made some Israelis nervous about handing too much power to the religious right. Our correspondent Iris Makler is in Jerusalem. Iris, welcome.
Thank you.
So just remind us, what did happen in Hebron at the weekend?
There was a Jewish religious event attended by some 30,000 Israelis, many settlers from all other parts of the West Bank, who came to join the settlers in Hebron. While they were, that day apparently went quite well, so the settlers reported, until about halfway through, when young men, they said, who came from outside, began attacking both Palestinians and Israeli soldiers, because that was all captured on video. It was a day that everybody remembers for the attacks on Israeli soldiers, including a young female soldier who actually lives in Hebron itself, and she found herself on the ground being attacked by someone with a stick.
Were they religiously motivated or nationalists?
It's always hard to determine that, but what the police and the army have said is that they were the ones starting the violence. After a while, the Israeli soldiers were between attacking Israelis and responding Palestinians, but that's how they portrayed it. Were they religious or were they nationalist or were they both? It's not clear. They were there for a religious purpose. From what we could see in the videos, they definitely looked like they were wearing the clothes that religious Jews who live in the settlements where, but I think their motives are a mixture of both.
Now, this violence, how difficult has this made it for Benjamin Netanyahu trying to put together this coalition government? Has it raised a wariness, has it raised an alarm among moderates in the Knesset about bringing far-right parties in?
Those two things don't contradict each other because, yes, there is alarm. I think that's why this received so much coverage. There's a lot of violence in Hebron over a long time that doesn't receive this much coverage. I think it did receive this much coverage because of the alarm that people feel that these far-right parties are going to be in the Knesset in a very short time. But because the moderate parties feel alarm doesn't necessarily stop the hand of Benjamin Netanyahu, who has said that what he wants is a full right-wing government, as he puts it, and these are his far-right partners.
He doesn't want to send the message, though, that his government will tolerate this kind of nationalist or religious violence. I guess I'm just wondering what he's been saying in response to this.
Very quiet in response to this. Even Itamar Ben-Gvir, one of the two leaders who is most worrying, he's from the far-right Jewish Power Party. He's a Kahanist, which means he's a former disciple of the racist Rabbi Meir Kahane, who was assassinated. He says he is no longer a supporter of Rabbi Kahane, but he went to the commemoration of his death within the last 2 weeks. So he attended that. Even he wasn't to be seen for the first 24 hours. So you can see that this is worrying, and what they want is for it to all quieten down so that they can just swear this government in and begin to tackle the issues for which they say they have been elected by a large majority. It's quite interesting. You have to say that Benjamin Netanyahu is a political wizard, because in fact, there isn't much difference between the results this time and last time. And the difference between Benjamin Netanyahu and the opposition is 30,000 votes in all. But nevertheless, it did translate into an 8-seat majority. And so he is placed to put together a government with these allies.
Now, that religious Zionist party, I believe it's made demands for national security cabinet positions, including positions that would have some authority in the West Bank. Is Benjamin Netanyahu willing to give this religious Zionist party that level of power?
He hasn't completed negotiations yet, so what I'm saying is slightly speculative. But it seems that the religious Zionist parties was an alliance cobbled together by Benjamin Netanyahu to secure a majority in this election. They've now separated. One of them, Itamar Ben-Gvir, has demanded, and it seems will receive, the public security minister role that's in charge of the police, and he wants additional powers in the West Bank. The other, Bezalel Smotrich, wanted to be the defence minister, and that, I think, is not going to happen. He is likely to be the treasurer, the finance minister. Bezalel Smotrich has indicated he wants a minister, a junior minister from his party in the defence ministry, even though he will no longer be the defence minister. So you can see that they are making large demands. I have heard people from inside Netanyahu's party, the Likud party, complaining that he's acceding to their demands too much, not giving enough portfolios to his own party. But yes, it seems that they make demands and those demands are met, even though they want controversial postings in light of their own history.
Just finally and briefly, there is a suite of issues the religious Zionists are requesting of Benjamin Netanyahu. Briefly tell us what some of those are.
Here's the major thing, that not just the religious Zionists, the ultra-Orthodox and the Likud, everybody wants a hand in this one. And what they want is an override clause. Like many governments all around the world, they don't like it when the courts interfere with legislation and override it for some reason. And they want to override the courts in turn. They want to interfere with the independence of the judiciary. And everybody has their own special niche interests. For example, the religious Zionist parties want to retroactively legalize settlements in the West Bank that are built on private Palestinian land and aren't legal. The ultra-Orthodox parties want to establish a precedent whereby young ultra-Orthodox men won't be conscripted into Israel's military. Conscription is compulsory here. That's hugely controversial. The other thing they want, they've just announced this week, is to separate men and women in public spaces and to put that into law too. All these things not possible right now. And what they want to ensure is that if they do enact these laws, that the courts can't interfere.
Iris, Israel never ceases to be one of the most interesting places in international politics. I'm always grateful for your insights. Iris Makler in Jerusalem, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
If you're a doctor opposed to euthanasia or a nurse with qualms about abortion, should you have the right to opt out of such procedures, even if they're entrenched in law? Australian ethicist Dr. Xavier Simons wades into these and many thorny similar questions in his new book, Why Conscience Matters.
I think that doctors will often deem a particular practice to be not conducive to the proper goals or ends of healthcare. So they may think that a particular procedure, which they deem to be harming a patient, doesn't realise the goal of health or healing that they take to be central to medicine. Of course, there are fairly straightforward religious reasons why a medical professional may have a conscientious objection. And those are probably well known to the public, such as a Catholic doctor who won't perform abortions, or a Christian doctor who doesn't want to participate in the provision of euthanasia. Or it could even be fairly idiosyncratic, unusual objections. There may be a doctor who objects to the provision of certain medications that were developed using testing on animals. There's different circumstances in which conscientious objection can take place, but I think the key factor is typically a moral or a religious conviction that what one is being asked to do is something that's morally or religiously objectionable.
Yeah, we're going to discuss some of those in a minute, but you make many interesting points. One of the most interesting, though, is the nature of a doctor's role. Is she an agent of the state or of the free market? First of all, in many Western developed and democratic countries, as you know, with national health care, isn't a doctor nowadays simply an agent of the state?
There are definitely some bioethicists and doctors who would claim that doctors are no more than mere apparatchiks of the state, but I think that is going a bit far. I think that it's true to say that they are participating within a public system, for example, public healthcare in Australia and the Medicare system or the NHS in the United Kingdom. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're equivalent to a public servant. In fact, I think we could draw clear distinctions between, say, fairly repetitive and pro forma tasks that certain people within the public service may have to perform, and the case of a doctor dealing with a very complex medical situation, which requires not only keen clinical judgment, but also the consideration of a range of moral issues. We might think, for example, of an ICU doctor deciding whether a patient should cease treatment, have life support withdrawn, whether some experimental treatment or other should be pursued. And I think those are two very different cases, and that draws out the distinction between a doctor understood as a professional and a doctor understood as a mere public servant.
What's a potential problem, Xavier, of a doctor being simply seen as an agent of the state? Because historically, it could have some very dark undertones.
That's correct. And I've written on this topic at length to try and defend the practice of conscientious objection. Unfortunately, it's a fact, a historical fact, that medicine has got it wrong and got it wrong in very serious and shockingly consequential ways over the course of history. So, for example, the institutional racism that was part and parcel of medical care in the United States for the 19th and early 20th centuries, or the eugenics movement, also particularly most shockingly manifested in the American healthcare system. I think when we look at those examples of state-sanctioned, state-backed abuses in medicine, we start to see a bit of a problem with a very simple, uniform approach to thinking about the role of a doctor and the way in which a doctor should approach moral issues. When instead we take into account not only the state role that healthcare performs, but also the need for doctors to be morally discerning themselves and not mere apparatchiks of the state, then we start to see a bit more the role of conscience in medicine and how it can complement rather than necessarily conflict with professional standards and law.
Yeah. And what's the problem with doctors being agents of the free market? Because again, in some places like the United States, doctors are businessmen. So what is the conscience problem if a doctor is merely a servant of the market?
It's pretty easy to see what can go wrong when a doctor's simply following the dollars and not their better judgment. When we simply think of doctors as agents of the market, then we end up with a situation in which doctors are performing procedures that patients can pay for simply because they can pay for them and not necessarily because they're needed. And in fact, where doctors come to be conceived of as wish fulfillment clinicians rather than having a therapeutic as opposed to enhancement role. I mean, to give a very striking example, we can think of plastic surgery and not just reconstructive plastic surgery, but plastic surgery for cosmetic and aesthetic reasons. Unfortunately, as we've seen in Australia and elsewhere, that particular subspecialty has been prone to particularly egregious abuses and harms towards patients as a result of doctors, I think, thinking of themselves as pure agents of the market rather than having certain responsibilities to patients that go beyond the mere economic transaction that takes place between doctors and patients.
Well, let's get to the kind of really knotty part here, Xavier. Why do you think there needs to be specific exemptions for doctors and conscientious objection? Because I think you say that there's something about the character formation of the doctor that's as important as her treatment.
That's correct. And this is a more controversial aspect of my book. I wouldn't go so far as to say we have a situation where there's a trade-off between character formation of doctors and the provision of good treatment and care and appropriate care for patients. I actually like to see it as a complementary situation where the formation of doctors that takes place where doctors have due discretionary space to pursue what they take to be the medical good will lead to better care for patients. And that's why I think that paradoxically, a right to conscientious objection actually will lead to patients getting the treatments that they need ultimately in the long run. Unfortunately, we're entering a situation where there are many people within the healthcare system and within bioethics generally who would argue that doctors should not be able to exercise moral judgment by the bedside or in the operating theatre or in any other medical context, but rather there should be professional standards that are followed with a kind of blind adherence rather than a moral reflection and critical engagement.
There is this challenge, though, and you identify it in the book, and I acknowledge it's almost certain never to happen. But what if every doctor raised a conscientious objection to a particular procedure? That particular procedure, which might be medically necessary, might never get done.
That's true. But I think when people raise this objection, they are really confusing the question of conscientious objection with broader questions about how we should legislate for change within medicine and what should be done once a controversial medical procedure has been legalized. Who is responsible for making it happen, for ushering in a new medical regime? The reality is, if the state would like to do something that ultimately cuts against the grain and ultimately is contrary to the opinion of a medical majority, then the state needs to be prepared to create a situation in which patients can access the kind of care that's been legalized, even though a majority of doctors may have a moral objection to it. And the example I think of is euthanasia. In Victoria, the Victorian state government, after legalizing euthanasia, took it upon itself and also the Department of Health Services in Victoria to make euthanasia readily available for patients across the state. And they designed a system whereby that could happen without conflicting with the majority of clinicians' view that euthanasia is not something that medicine should be providing. That is really a good test case or a good example of how this issue should be resolved rather than forcing doctors to perform procedures to which they have not only genuine objection, but a reasonable objection, an objection that's actually quite widely held within the profession.
I mean, here's an interesting philosophical point, though, and I know you're a philosopher as well. Doesn't the notion of conscientious objection rely on the knowledge that someone else will do what the objector considers the dirty work.
It's possible. I mean, it's also possible that the situation may be that a patient may not receive access to that particular medical procedure. But what I argue is that if it's the case that that medical procedure doesn't fall within the bounds of what we might consider basic medical care, so the kind of care that's curative, that's therapeutic, if in fact that procedure falls more within the bounds of what we might consider a social dimension of healthcare, which is interventions that are more designed for complex life situations that people might find themselves in, but that traditionally haven't fallen within the bounds of basic medical care. If that's the situation and no doctor's prepared to provide that particular procedure, should we be actually rethinking the way we think about that procedure and considering it to be part of healthcare? I mean, if there are so many practitioners who don't want to do something, well, then maybe that is actually cause for us as the general public and healthcare policymakers to reflect on whether we've got it wrong, whether we have in fact got it wrong on that particular issue or other. And that's why I say that conscientious objection should not be conceived of as a sanction for idiosyncratic medical practice, but rather precisely to draw upon the language of conscience. It's like a prick to the conscience of society that leads us to think twice about the way we do things in healthcare.
Yeah, look, just finally, I mean, obviously there's a couple of examples that I can think of and the listeners will be thinking of. Basically, if you don't believe in blood transfusions and if you don't believe in an abortion if it's necessary to save the life of the mother, I mean, could you really be a doctor? Extreme cases, but they may well come up.
In my book, I outline a series of criteria of reasonableness that I think should govern conscientious objection. I'm not a proponent of an unbridled right to conscientious objection. I do think that conscientious objection should be regulated and there should be clear standards as to when someone has a right to conscientiously object. And at the very least, I think the conscientious objectors need to be open and upfront and transparent about the procedures that they are and are not willing to perform. That's the way we avoid those sorts of situations where, for example, people can't get access to blood transfusions. Admittedly, that's not an example that I could find anywhere in the literature. I know that there are patients who might have that objection. I didn't come across any doctors, but it may be the case. And then also in the case of a doctor who might not be willing to perform an abortion to save the life of the mother, I think that the doctor should be open about that, so that the hospital that they're working for or the healthcare network that they're part of is aware that they have a conscientious objector who's not able to perform that procedure and appropriate alternative arrangements should be made. It's more a question of making sure that there's clear and frank and open conversations that take place well before the fact in the context of these healthcare dilemmas, such that we can have a situation where doctors are allowed to act based on their conscience, but also where patients can receive care.
Dr. Xavier Simmons, author of Why Conscience Matters, A Defence of Conscientious Objection in Healthcare. And there's a longer version of that discussion at the Religion and Ethics Report homepage or when you download the ABC Listen app and search for the program there. Thanks to Mudita Dias and Simon Branthwaite. I'm Andrew West. Join us again for the Religion and Ethics Report.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.